The debt crisis in Europe is taking a toll on Spain's wine market. Many Spaniards can no longer afford their own beloved Rioja, so the country's winemakers are looking abroad for a much-needed bump in sales. Lauren Freyer reports.
Judging from the crowds in Spain's tapas bars, you might wonder where the economic crisis is. But there's been a subtle change. Many are drinking less wine or switching to beer.
It's more expensive to have a good wine, and you can get two beers for the same price that you can get one wine.
Marta Juan Seva sips a cerveza at a sidewalk cafe in Madrid. Her friend Carlos Zavala chimes in. He's unemployed but says staying home is not an option.
In Spain, everyone socializes in bars and restaurants, and every single block at least there's a bar.
And the bars measure the economic tides in Spain. Wine used to be just for the dinner table, but after the euro and Spain's construction boom, fancy wine bars started popping up. Spain's foremost wine expert, José Peñin, says those bars made wine cool. But unfortunately, that's also coincided with the economic crisis, he says. So we've seen no growth in domestic consumption. That's hurt even the oldest wineries in Rioja, the Spanish region famous for shipping grapes to France in the 19th century, when a plague wiped out Bordeaux's harvest. Legend has it aristocrats couldn't tell the difference between French and Spanish grapes, and Rioja has flourished since then. Maria José López de Heredia runs Rioja's Viña Tondonia winery, which her great-grandfather founded. On a tour of its cavernous cellar, she explains her business model.
The problem is that the restaurants were demanding for dropping the prices. And I told them, no way, because my costs are the same. I started to sell more abroad.
She's hoping to sell half her wines overseas this year, up from 30% a few years ago. Spanish wines go mostly to Germany, the UK, and America. But now a neighboring vintner, Simón Arena, is learning Chinese.
China bring wines because it's prestigious. Buy the more expensive wine in China.
China ranks fifth for Spanish wine exports, but it's the biggest growth market. And there's volume here to export. Spain has the most wine acreage in the world. But economist Pankaj Ghemawat says Spanish winemakers face stiff competition.
If you think of the number of new wine growers around the world, Australia, Chile, South Africa, and how low costs are in some of these locations, especially the ones that have gone in for an industrial approach to winemaking, competing head-to-head with them doesn't sound like a great idea.
Back at the Viña Tondonia winery, owner Maria José strolls past oak barrels, reassuring herself that the family business is strong enough to take on new challenges.
My grandfather died when I was 17. He was 96 years old, and he told us a lot of stories about the war, and my father started from zero after the war. So I'm aware in my family of what it is suffering and going through very difficult times.
Outside in the fields, workers are pruning the same grapevines Maria José's great-grandfather planted. Inside, she pops open a bottle of red and wonders where next year's harvest will end up. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Rioja, Spain.
You are listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. In France, an elderly man is fighting to leave the Catholic Church. But he doesn't just want to stop going to church. He wants to make a formal break by nullifying his baptism. And he has sued the Catholic Church to make that happen. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports the case could have far-reaching effects.
Comme dans les films, vous savez.
71-year-old René Le Bouvier opens the gate of the churchyard in the tiny village of Fleury in the Manche region. His parents and brother are buried here. He himself was baptized in the Romanesque stone church and attended Mass here as a boy. Le Bouvier says this rural area of northwest France is still conservative and very Catholic, but nothing like it used to be. Back then, you couldn't even get credit at the bakery if you didn't go to Mass every Sunday, he says. Le Bouvier grew up in that world and says his mother once hoped he'd become a priest. But he says his views began to change in the 1970s when he was introduced to free thinkers. As he didn't believe in God anymore, he thought it would be more honest to leave the church. So he wrote to his diocese and asked to be unbaptized.
And they sent me a copy of my records, and in the margins next to my name, they wrote that I had chosen to leave the church.
That was in the year 2000. A decade later, Le Bouvier wanted to go further. In between were the pedophile scandals and the Pope preaching against condoms in AIDS-racked Africa, which Le Bouvier calls criminal. Again, he asked the church to strike him from baptismal records. When the priest told him it wasn't possible, he took the church to court. Last October, a judge in Normandy ruled in his favor. The diocese has since appealed, and the case is pending.
One can't be debaptized.
That's Reverend Robert Caslin, dean of the School of Canon Law at the Catholic University of America. Caslin says baptism changes one permanently before the church and God.
One could refuse the grace offered by God, the grace offered by the sacrament, refuse to participate, but we would believe the individual has still been marked for God through the sacrament, and that individual at any point could return to the church.
French law states that citizens have the right to leave organizations if they wish. Lou Demont has been following the case for French Catholic newspaper La Croix. He thinks it could set a legal precedent and open the way for more demands for debaptism.
If the justice confirms that the name of René Le Bouvier has to disappear from the books, if it is confirmed, it can be a kind of jurisprudence in France.
Up to now, observers say the debaptism trend has been marginal, but it's growing. In neighboring Belgium, the Brussels Federation of Friends of Secular Morality reports that 2,000 Catholics asked to be debaptized in 2010, and French newspaper Le Monde reports that about 1,000 French people a year ask to have their baptisms annulled.
Die Verbrechen, die von zwangsentsexualisierten Priestern.
There is much anger across the continent over the recent pedophile scandals. In September, Germans marched to protest the Pope's visit. Christian Weissner is with the German branch of the grassroots reform movement We Are Church. He says Europeans still want religion and they want to believe, but it has become very difficult within the Catholic Church.
It's the way that the Roman Catholic Church has not followed the new approach of democracy, the new approach of the women's issue, and there's really a big gap between the Roman Catholic Church and modern times.
Back at the church in Fleury, Le Bouvier stands by his parents' grave. I ask him if the case has ruined his chances of being buried in the family plot here. I don't have to worry about it, he says. I've donated my body to science. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News.
Whether it's creationism versus evolution, miracles versus magic tricks, or faith versus fact, religion and science have long been pitted against one another. But in his latest book, called Where the Conflict Really Lies, philosopher Alvin Plantinga argues that the real incompatibility is between religion and naturalism, a philosophical view that denies the existence of any spiritual or supernatural reality. Religion and science, he says, share more common ground than you might think. For example, scientists may argue that miracles can't exist because they defy scientific laws. But Plantinga says, actually, that's not true.
These laws are all stated for closed systems. A closed system is one such that there isn't any causal input into it from the outside. Nothing outside the system is causing something to happen.
Okay, so that's a closed system. Now, the miracle.
Suppose God created a horse in Times Square in New York City. Any system in which that horse came to be would not be a closed system.
So no scientific law is applicable.
And therefore there wouldn't be any conflict between God's doing that miracle, let's say, and the scientific laws.
So Plantinga says science and religion don't conflict as long as they respect each other's boundaries.
I think science is wonderful, important, maybe the most impressive intellectual episode of the past half a millennium has been the development of science. I also am a Christian. If there is an alleged incompatibility between them, well, that disturbs me. It's something I want to look into and see whether or not that is in fact so. And my argument is for the conclusion that it isn't so.
That sounds like what you're saying is that there has been a reticence to recognize common ground between science and religion. Why has there been such a reticence? If these intersections are so obvious, why do people emphasize the differences?
Well, of course, science started off in the bosom of Christian belief in the West. The early scientists, Newton, Boyle, and so on, were all believers in God. And they saw science as a way of exploring the world that God has created. I think the present emphasis on conflict arises at least in part because a number of thinkers try to co-opt science into the services of atheism, and they want to use science as a kind of weapon in the battle between atheism and theistic religion.
You yourself are a Christian. Is there not a big part of your own personal religious doctrine that depends on faith, taking a leap of faith philosophically, and believing in certain things that simply can't be scientifically proven?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that can't be scientifically proven that everybody accepts. That there's been a past, for example. Bertrand Russell once said that as far as our evidence goes, the whole world could have popped into existence 5 minutes ago, complete with all the crumbling mountains and rusting automobiles and apparent memories and the like. Do we have a scientific proof that that's not so? Well, of course not. I mean, science presupposes that there has been a past. It doesn't prove that there has been. So, I mean, it's not as if whatever is true or sensible to believe has to be provable by virtue of science. Science is absolutely wonderful, but it's a limited endeavor. It doesn't cover the whole of the knowledge enterprise, you might say.
Can you talk a little bit about what it is like to be a religious person, a Christian, in the world of philosophical academia?
Well, when I began as a philosopher many years ago, 50 years ago or so, there were very few Christians in philosophy, and the few there were for the most part inclined to keep their heads down, so to speak. The subject, philosophy, was heavily secular. That's not true anymore. Now maybe, I don't know, perhaps as many as a sixth of philosophers are believers in God of one kind or another, and maybe a higher proportion of graduate students in philosophy are. And I'm sort of delighted to see that Christianity is doing much better in the philosophical world now than it was when I began in philosophy.
Do you have atheists in your circle of friends?
Yes, I do. Yeah, sure.
Do you talk about this stuff all the time, or you just kind of agree to just relax and talk about football or the weather or not address the big issues?
In college and in graduate school, you do that kind of thing. But after you've been at it quite a long time, then you are more inclined to set those things aside because you know how the conversation will go anyway. It really won't go anywhere. And you talk about other things. But it doesn't just have to be about football. Even when you're at Notre Dame, there are topics besides God and football. Maybe not very many, but some.
Alvin Plantinga is a professor emeritus of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. His latest book is called Where the Conflict Really Lies, and he joined us from member station WGVU in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Dr. Plantinga, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Facebook is getting a new look. The social networking site has begun to roll out a new feature. It's called Timeline, and it allows anyone to scroll through years of posts and photos in just minutes. Facebook's executives say Timeline will let people, quote, tell the stories of their lives in graphically beautiful ways. It could also reveal some embarrassing moments from the past, and soon Facebook is going to require all 800 million members to adopt it. NPR's Steve Henn reports.
This week, I went down to Nola's. It's a bar in Palo Alto that's popular with Stanford students and techies. And there, Facebook's timeline is kind of old news.
We both have it.
It's been great for months, eh?
Narelle Alana and Darwin Spruce Byer were standing outside, both draped in the Australian flag, holding drinks and snapping pictures.
Hey! Hey. Australia Day!
They say timeline's nothing to be afraid of. And the truth is, anyone who's wanted to change their Facebook profile and set up their own timeline has been able to do it for months.
I'm a developer, so it just went straight on, eh?
When Mark Zuckerberg unveiled Timeline last summer, Facebook opened it up to software developers. Those developers shared the keys, and soon anyone could get in. Millions did, from my kid's baby sister to Britney Spears. And this feature, Timeline, looks kind of like what you'd expect. It's a timeline, but instead of scrolling horizontally across the page, it scrolls down, and it makes old, embarrassing posts easy to find. In the early days of social media, lots of us posted things online we wouldn't have wanted our grandmother or our clients to see. But lucky for me, by the time I was allowed into Facebook, I was old enough to know better. Sam Sanders wasn't so lucky.
I was a sophomore in college, I remember.
Sam has something like 2,000 Facebook friends. He grew up online. And once upon a time, Sam wasn't so careful about his posts.
There were just lots of photos of me in big group hugs holding alcohol. You know, like lots of those.
Now he's a producer at NPR, so I decided it might be kind of fun to turn on his Facebook timeline together. Sam was feeling confident.
Because the day before I started my first job after grad school, I went on like a Facebook photo purging spree.
He was sure he had cleaned up his act since college, grown up, purged the inappropriate from his digital record.
And I joined in 2005, so I clicked there. Oh my God. Oh, it just pulled up some ridiculously old photos of me.
There were pictures of Sam playing air guitar.
Oh, God.
With a friend's leg. Shots of him drinking. A dance montage that would make any grown man blush.
This is so bad.
And this video of Sam playing the sax.
Oh, no. The scariest thing that I'm seeing right now, it says, click publish now or wait until your timeline goes live on February 2nd. So, like, whether or not I want this, it's going to happen.
Facebook gives everyone 7 days from when you first sign on to Timeline before all those old photos and videos are republished. So forget your work deadlines. You have more important things to do. Facebook is calling. It wants you to put in a couple hours, right now, creating beautiful new content for its site. Or at least content that's not hideously embarrassing. So I asked Sam, how many hours do you think it would take you to clean this up?
I can't even begin to fathom. I cannot even begin to say.
And while Sam may be spending this weekend sanitizing his Facebook page, back at Nola's in Palo Alto, Joe Moosehart says there is another option.
Yeah, I'm probably considering canceling my entire account.
Really?
Really. Like with the job I'm working now, if there's some things from my past that come up, I mean, there'd be completely different opinions about me.
He says sometimes it's better if the past remains in the past. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin. This summer at the Olympic Games in London, women will compete in the boxing ring for the very first time. And next month, some of the top female American boxers will gather in Spokane, Washington, to vie for a spot on the U.S. team. WNYC's Marianne McCune spoke with some of the hopefuls about why they love this traditionally male sport.
Women who box love it for the same reasons guys do. Boxing requires intense physical and psychological discipline, the ability to overcome fear and anger.
I think boxing is therapeutic. It keeps you under control. You know, it controls your body.
This is Bertha Arisol, 29 years old. She loves to cook.
And I'm an amateur boxer.
When I met her, she was living in a basement apartment in the Bronx with a man and a woman she called her husband.
So strong, Papi.
And her wife. Hello? They were cooking for a band of nieces, nephews, and sisters, part of a big family of Cuban immigrants. Arisol is 5'9" with jeans, boots. She says her many tattoos tell the story of who she is. She points to a pit bull and a strawberry.
I love strawberries.
As a teenager, Arisol was the pit bull. Like a lot of guys who box, she was a street fighter first, until she got locked up for 5 years.
Before I started boxing, I thought you have to be in a ring and be angry to actually win, you know? But you can actually win a fight and don't have, like, nothing malicious in your mind, nothing, you know? You can actually be calm and happy and win. That's what I like about boxing, because I can't believe I can actually fight in the ring and think. When you beat somebody, you're better than them. That's what's satisfying me. I want to be better than you.
So any good boxer derives that kind of satisfaction. Here's what's different for a woman. She's taking on a challenge no one expects her to.
Okay, here we go, on the bell.
I think women are one of the fiercest competitors there are. But they've been taught to suppress a lot of things.
Coach Gloria Peak is with USA Boxing.
It's not ladylike. It is not ladylike to do this, this, and that.
Peak is in a California gym, helping train a diverse group of fighters that Bertha Arasil will have to beat in order to make the U.S. Olympic team.
Change the speed on her a little bit.
Peak started boxing in the 1970s, against many odds.
My mother dressed me up so pretty in these little dresses and everything like that. And I come home with my dress torn, bleeding and all that, because I've been in a fight. My mother's like, Gloria, what were you doing? Fighting. This guy got all in my face, threw a punch. I let him know that I wasn't afraid of him. No, no, it's ladylike to be afraid. Why? Nobody has an intelligent answer.
Now she calls boxing the last great domain of men.
I think of it as like the gladiators and, you know, the immortals and the gods. That was always men. And now all of a sudden women have stepped into it.
Women like Michaela Mayer, who's here wailing on a heavy bag. Mayer will compete against Arasil to represent the U.S. at 132 pounds. She's tall, with cover girl looks, and says she wears heels as often as possible.
I like the fact that I'm feminine outside the ring and on the streets, and, you know, I may not seem like a boxer, but really, you know, I am a boxer, and I have that side to me. And I can be a woman, and I can be an aggressive athlete.
Tierra Brown is on the speed bag. Another opponent for Arasil.
I'm a boxer. I want to be treated like the guys are treated, like a boxer. I don't want special treatment because I'm a girl. No.
On the other hand...
For one, I have a big old juicy booty, and it's shaped like a cherry. I have abs of steel, and then I have these sexy, luscious lips, and I've got these guns on my arms. I'm a boxer, and I'm a girl boxer.
I love looking at women going to ring and box. I think that's real sexy.
We're back in Bertha Arasil's basement bedroom.
To go in the ring and switch up and be strong and can take punches and receive on them, it showed me my strong side, like my fearless side. Nothing soft when I'm in the ring. I can be in there and be aggressive and fight and get out of there and be sweet.
The three tough and sweet fighters you just met will compete against each other and five other women in the lightweight division for a spot on the U.S. Olympic team. For NPR News, I'm Marianne McCune in New York.
Our story is part of a series produced with WNYC in New York and the New York Times. Sue J. Johnson co-produced the series, and her photo essay on the women boxers appears in today's New York Times magazine. For more, go to npr.org.